Major Arthur Flint, Reel 4. Major Flint, you mentioned that some men were quicker to learn than others. Was there sort of a gaps in the sort of run?
Oh, yes. I mean, of the chaps who joined, let's say for every 12, I suppose you could say a couple of them fell out during the course of the training. They didn't really complete their 4 years training. You were expected to stay in the TA. For example, if somebody got shifted in his job from London up to Glasgow, well, obviously he couldn't do his drills in London. So they were expected to transfer into some other TA unit, but if they couldn't do it, well, they were discharged and that was the end of it. Of the average chaps that we had, everybody had a fairly good smattering of gunnery, of drill, gunnery, driving, and operating. The bulk of people were fairly good drivers, pretty average machine gunners. Wireless operators, perhaps not, in my time, perhaps not quite so qualified as they might have been, because it was one of the things that was sort of coming up. It was still in its infancy, as far as we were concerned. Tactically, and having been through the war and seen how things developed there, I suppose you could say that it also was very much in its infancy. But bear in mind, we did no more than we were trained by the regular army. The regular army was equally at sea as far as the tactics and so forth were concerned. There was a tremendous discussions and arguments as to how the army should be employed and how it should be formed and equipped. And it's still going on today, I suppose. But as far as the tank was concerned, you appreciate the bulk of the regular army was equipped with modern tanks, so-called modern tanks, around about beginning of 1939, or say end of 38. Prior to that, they'd been equipped with these old Vickers mediums things that I'm talking about, and light tanks. And basically on the theory that it was cheaper to have a light tank than a heavy armoured thing, they produced the light tank, the Mark 6B, which was a death trap, really, a lightly armoured thing, although people fought them during the war, and they fought them in Dunkirk, in the Dunkirk period. And the Matilda, which was got about 4.5 or 5 inches of armour on it, that was a heavier tank. But they didn't really come in until about 1939. I remember seeing them driving about around Aldershot on the testing ranges when we were down there doing our training. People said, by God, what's that? It's an experimental thing. And that turned out to be one of these Matildas under training. And the first one we had, this is long after my WD period when I was in the 42nd Royal Tank Regiment, we were issued with a Matilda in 1939, and it was sent down to us at night by train, and it had to be unloaded at night and driven up in the darkness by the workshops officer, who had a special course on this thing to drive it, and they built a shed in a field, and it was put into the shed, and no bugger was allowed to take it out of the shed. It stayed in its shed. It was that secret. And people did their little training, sort of standing around and looking at it, and climbing in and out. Hopeless when you kind of think of it.
How many armoured cars did you have at this period when you
at
were
Elverton
learning?
Street? At Elverton Street, the headquarters, we had two. And these of course were flossed up for ceremonial parades and so on, but normally when we went to annual training we had the full complement, which was I think 16 armoured cars to the unit.
But you only had them for 2 weeks a year?
Oh yes. They were a pool of old Rolls-Royce armoured cars. We got the same cars year after year after year.
But your regular two were kept in a garage there?
Yes. We had a couple of Rolls-Royce armoured cars there. There was a Rolls-Royce tender. There was a 3-ton lorry, was it a 30-hundredweight lorry, and some smaller sort of staff cars, and these 1,500-weights. But normally, these were used for the evening training, But we could go, we did go on weekends, weekend trainings, and ultimately later on in the, when we became more tank corps than armoured cars, we used to do tank training, tank driving down at Aldershot. So that was later on.
Did you feel that you were short of equipment? Was
there a feeling? Oh, yes. Well, how can I put it? I was interested in it, you know, I became very interested in it, and of course I used to make it my business to find out, and I realised, or it was obvious to me, and I think any thinking person, it was obvious to me how badly equipped we were for war. And I mean, 38, there was this, the Germans marched into Czechoslovakia and so forth, and it was obvious the bust was coming sooner or later. And I had one or two friends in the War Office, regular soldiers in the tank corps, who were working in the mechanisation branch, and I used to sort of have lunch with these chaps and chat with them. And I used to ask quite pertinent questions, you know, any idea when we're going to get anything modern? You know, you think you're so lucky, you only got about six in the bloody country. This sort of statement was made true or not, I don't know, but it couldn't have been much better than that. And the number of Packer modern tanks were available in 1939 was deplorable. That's one of the reasons why they got knocked about so badly in the Dunkirk. The tank brigade, it's such, they hadn't got enough tanks to fully equip that, and they went into action with the infantry tank Mark I, which was quite a heavily armoured thing, but it only had a Vickers machine gun in it. And the tracks, the theory of it was that they were exposed so they could be easily changed, but they got shot and blown off. And they were a few Matildas. The cavalry, the so-called armoured divisions, the cavalry units, they were armed with A9s, a cruiser tank, or a number of cruiser tanks. They didn't have a full complement of cruiser tanks. And all these light tanks, these Mark 6s, the Vickers things, the little short thing. And of course they got shot to bloody pieces.
These people that you knew who were working in the War Office, mm-hmm. what sort of things did they say about their sort
well,
of work?
Apart from the fact that things, what shall I say? They, you know, there was a. They were hoping that equipment would come forward, but it was a matter of money as much as anything. There had been such a long time lag in the 30s. And this disarmament business, everything cut back. I mean, there's no money for development and so forth. So it really meant that there wasn't any equipment when it was needed.
Who were they working for?
Well, they were working in the mechanisation branches and so on. They were called equipment branches. You know, perhaps I shouldn't say too much about that because it's probably a official secrets breaking. But I mean, they didn't let go anything that was of a. Top secret nature, anything like that. It was just general conversation.
They were what, civilians, were they?
They were warrant officers and so forth, and who were seconded into the War Office for working in these different branches.
What was the? Did you have a Rolls Royce engine that you stripped down and worked on? Did you?
Yes, they were stripped. The driving and maintenance. Apart from the road training, we also taught the maintenance side, and they had various engines which are either sectionalised or actually running, sort of mocked up on a stand, and they could run, and you could sort of do the adjustments on running engines, and they were sectionalised for showing how, you know, how the gearboxes worked and all that sort of thing. We weren't fitters or anything like that. I mean, we didn't get to that standard, but we could do ordinary sort of running breakdowns on the thing.
And did you have a lot of breakdowns and problems like that?
Not really. We used to get breakdowns on these pool cars that we had. And I was on one where we broke a half shaft. That wasn't probably wear and tear; it was probably bad driving by somebody that said we broke a half shaft. And we sort of spent the night out while they went and got another half shaft. Or you could withdraw the half shaft on a Rolls and put it in. We got a complete new axle. had to jack the bloody thing up and put in a new rear axle. It was quite interesting, of course. Took us all night, and drove on sort of the next morning. That was a question, I think, of knowledge, because the permanent staff knew where these, you know, the whatever ordnance depot it was had got this spare rear axle, and it sort of cut out all the bull and sort of went straight there and collected the axle and drove it back to where the car was broken down.
So you'd say that the standard of maintenance was fairly high, was it, isn't it, particularly?
Well, I wouldn't say it was high. The standard of maintenance was high, but the standard, I mean, we hadn't got any workshops people or anything like that. We had a small so-called black squad, as they were called, but I wouldn't classify them as fitters in the accepted state of the word.
Were you tested for this, like other things?
Not till later. Perhaps I ought to explain, there was a sort of time period in this thing. When I first went in, it was 1932, we did, I don't know if we talk about annual training now, that would answer what you're talking about. The first year was at Pinehurst Barracks, and that was during the period of retrenchment and disarmament and what have you. And we actually had, we didn't get paid. They said the TA wouldn't get paid. They couldn't afford to pay the TA. So anybody that went to camp wouldn't get any pay. But we got our pay, and it had to be paid back to the government for our food. So we got, you might say, free accommodation, but we didn't get any money. I think they also cut back on the bounty that year as well. We did, of course, those of us who were employed, and our employers gave us holiday to go to camp. It was only a week's training. We got, I think I got half of it paid, and the rest I had to do without pay. So we were actually paying to be in, not to, you know, we wouldn't get anything out of it. There's no question of that. And we took a remarkably dim view of it, I might say, as well. And, you know, the people that sort of were forcing that sort of attitude on us. But that was an armoured car business. I know there was a certain, we were with the 2nd Tanks in Pinehurst Barracks, and they were a modern unit, and in comparison to the rest of the army, in our opinion, something coming up and coming. And they actually had ice cream for tea. And this was, you know, this was something, bearing in mind the sort of bullion biscuits attitude of the rest of it. 1933, we went to Wallingford, and that was a complete armoured car camp. You know, we had our about 16 armoured cars, and we operated as an armoured car unit. We did an exercise against the regular tank brigade who were on the plane, and in those days, armoured cars were supposed to find a hole in sort of river line defences and break through and generally sort out the headquarters and so forth at the back. And I was on one of these things, and I know they had a river line south of Spain, I think it was the River Wiley, if I remember rightly. And not only were the tank corps there, but there were infantry and artillery units. And we came driving up to this bridge, or where we knew the bridge would be, and we couldn't see anything. And all of a sudden there was a flash and a bang, a bloody great wallop. And they had a 4-5 how camouflaged covering this bridge. And they let, only with blank, mark you, but they let fly with this blank, frightened the living daylights out of us. And we nearly ran into the bridge as a result of it. But we also did some night exercises, the same thing. But that we were operating as a sort of an armoured car unit. Then in...
Can I ask you a few questions before you go on to the next year? First of all, were you doing any, before you even set off to go on the camp, were you doing any tactical exercises in preparation for this?
Well, yes, we used to go out and train with armoured cars, but usually one car covering another. It was sort of fire and movement. It was very, very, very elementary, though. And it was awfully difficult to do. They used to do what they call loop patrols. One car took up a position on a road, and sort of pointed its gun up the road and looked out to see if there was anything covering, while the other one drove forward, and that went into a sort of concealed position, and then you came up and went on. It was a looping,
That you did in London?
Well, no, we did it outside London. You couldn't do it in London, because the traffic was, you know, the trams and so on, you couldn't do that. That used to be one of the hazards of driving in London, the bloody trams backwards and forwards. You try to pass a tram and the tram could go at a bat, and the tram wouldn't let you pass, and it took a hell of a lot of pulling up. You weren't encouraged to drive very fast in London.
What about tactical exercises on sand?
We had sand table work. At, this was more when we became tanks rather than armoured cars. 1934 was an armoured car camp. And in 1935, we went to Lulworth. Now, in 1935, they decided that it wouldn't be the 22nd London Armoured Car Company, it would be the 22nd Battalion Royal Tank Corps. And we would become tank people as opposed to armoured car people. Yeah, sorry.
Before you went down to the summer camp on, say, to Pinehurst, for example, did you do any communications exercise work? You know, I know you mentioned wireless before.
Did you? We didn't. In the early days, there was very little wireless done. It was when we became tank people rather than armoured cars when the wireless came into it. But we used to do sort of ordinary road discipline and parking and how to stop and how to get off the road. And we made a thing about getting off the road when we stopped. We didn't leave the cars parked in dangerous positions and all that sort of thing. And also, in theory, we went into a sort of a tactical Ligo, as they were called, and we'd drive into woods and get the tanks or the armoured cars off the road and, if need be, camouflaged up if we stopped for a meal or anything like that.
In the 32 exercise that you went down to
Pinehurst. Well, there was practically nothing happened, and it was mostly the odd bit of map reading and so on. This was the day, this was a year when we paid to belong, and I think we were allocated a minute quantity of petrol. It was just about enough to get the cars down there and back, and a certain amount of fiddle was done with the second tanks to give us some more petrol so that you could actually drive the things to do some training on them.
But you didn't do any exercises that year?
No, not really. We were shown around the tanks at in Pinehurst, the second tanks, and it was only a week that we were down there. Actually, belted with rain for several years. It really fell down. So a lot of it was done indoors rather than outdoors.
What was your impression of the 2nd Tank Battalion?
Oh, pretty good. They were, they were an efficient unit. But, we went down on the Saturday and left again on the following Sunday week. So we were only there for just that week. We saw the chaps. We ate in the same mess hall. They were suitably impressed when we were given this ice cream. That was something. That was due to some. You see, there was no army catering corps in those days. Each unit was responsible for its own messing, and this is another thing that we were taught, particularly when it became sort of an officer producing unit. It was our responsibility to look after our men. They weren't exactly helpless, but we were expected to look after them and see that they ate and see that they got good food and see that they were properly housed and sort of, never mind yourself, you looked after other people. That was the basic sort of thing behind it. I must say there were one or two examples later on where that didn't come about, but that was the basic thing, certainly in the tank corps. And you never left anybody broken down by the side of the road. I mean, to sort of drive past and stick up two fingers and go on. That wasn't done. If somebody was broken down, you pulled up and lend a hand. And, if somebody was broken down, you made sure that somebody went back and retrieved them. That was the basic idea behind it. But I'm afraid, I don't want to say too much against the cavalry, but somebody got left behind in the cavalry, well, bloody hard luck, more fool he for breaking down. It was that a totally different sort of attitude.
You'd seen that happen, had you?
Oh, yes. I've certainly on exercises, I've seen soldiers walking about solidly plain on their flat feet who were well and truly lost. Literally lost. I was out. Come to think of it, I went out with a friend of mine, a chap called Jack Tatum, in the WDs, when we were sort of private soldiers. We went for a drink in Andover. And in the evening, and there was some chappie in there. He was crying. I thought, good God, you know, what's the matter with him? And he deserted. And what had caused this trouble, he was an infantryman. He'd been out on an exercise, and in those days they didn't have anti-tank guns or anything like that, but his section that he was in was supposed to be an anti-tank gun, and they had to wave a green and white flag or something. He was there that represented the gun, and he lost the bloody flag, and they'd sent him out. They just said, right, go back and find it. And he'd walked, you know, for miles over Salisbury Plain looking for this sodding thing, and finally given it up. And he got as far as Andover, and he was off. And he was almost a nutter, you know, out of his mind with this thing. And we sort of chatted him up and poured a couple of pints of beer in him and put him in the back of the car and sort of dumped him off at his unit and said, you know, give them half a dollar and say, buy your own bloody flag, which is what we would have done, you see, but there was a totally different attitude. You know, you lost your flag, you find it, or you pay for it.
Was he a territorial?
No, he was a regular soldier. I don't say he was a very good one, but that was the way. This was another thing. I don't know if it still goes on. I've been out of it long now. But if you did anything or damaged anything or lost anything, you paid for it. Private soldiers as well. You lost a boot brush, you know, you were put on a charge, or not necessarily put on a charge, you bought another one. Simple as that.
When you did the 33 exercise, you mentioned that down in Wallingford you did night exercises. Mm. Can you say what you were actually doing on those?
Oh, I know this much. I went to sleep driving the bloody armoured car and hit the bank. But this was the night part of it was very largely moving from one spot to another, in theory, to we'd been seen in a particular area and we'd been putting in an attack at a particular spot. And we withdrew in the evening and then drove through the night and came in, you know, sort of around the top of the exercise area instead of the bottom. But it was mostly this reconnaissance, finding a hole in the river line or defence line or whatever it was, getting through it, and generally creating Bobsy Die. And
how are you organised for this role then? Who were you attached to? And
well, we weren't attached to anybody. We were the Westminster Dragoons doing its annual training. And we were the sort of enemy to the, you know, the tank brigade that was doing its training on the plain. And whoever was organising the exercises for the, you know, the regular army people, organising the regular army exercises, we were sort of fitted into this, you know, this particular scheme. I think, I must admit, I wasn't on this particular thing. There was one car got into one of the infantry headquarters and started throwing clods of earth about, and you know, throwing clods of earth at generals was looked on as a pretty, you know, not quite the thing to do. A bit hellish funny, huh?
In that 33 exercise, did you do your own individual tactical exercises as well?
Yes, but this was more the you might say the sort of simple loop patrol stuff, and one section against another. But I don't want you to think that we were, shall I say, highly developed as a tactical unit. I wouldn't say that. I don't think our officers were qualified to that extent. I mean, bear in mind, I was a private soldier then. I had no control over what went on. I had to do as I was told. I'm not saying that the officers weren't, you know, efficient as far as they went, but I wasn't an officer then. I was a private soldier, or another rank, until 1938.
What were you doing as far as communications are concerned? Were you using wireless?
I don't remember wireless in 32 or 3. not fitted into the cars.
How would you go about then sending a signal?
A dispatch rider on a motorbike. Each section had a DR who actually was a sort of member of the headquarters side of it. We weren't normally taught motorcycle riding. This didn't come into it. Only one or two sort of selected people. Once they got the bike, you know, they stayed with it. Motorcycle riding, as far as we were concerned, came when we became tank people rather than armoured car people.
And did this dispatch thing work? Dispatch
riding? Yeah. Well, as far as it could. It very largely relied upon the efficiency of the map reading of the dispatch rider. We used to have one chap, he used to blind off, having been given his message, and off into the distance, and you'd see him sort of looking at his map to find out where the hell he was, where he got to go.
What was the standard of the map reading, would you say, in the WDs?
Oh, reasonable. It was my job, my civilian job, drawing bloody things and so forth, so I was looked upon as a sort of rather special animal as far as maps were concerned, and I made it my business to make sure that I could read them, you know, use them as well as draw them. Some people, all right, some people to this day, they've probably been 20 years in a bloody thing, they still can't get their map references right, and it's not unheard of.
Were any people lost on any of these things? This exercise?
What do you mean lost? What do you mean couldn't find a way? Oh yes, yes. Well, it happened in the regular army too. I mean, nothing. People, made mistakes in map reading, certainly.
At 35, you referred to it earlier on briefly.
Mm.
You, as the WDs, became crew members for the tank corps.
Yes and no. In 35, they announced that we were going to be the 22nd Battalion Royal Tank Regiment. They increased the size of the unit, and we would be the 22nd Battalion, and we would lose our armoured cars. We'd be tank soldiers as opposed to armoured car soldiers. And the first year, we did our annual training at Lulworth. Actually, we still had our armoured cars with us then, but we went through the AFV school at Lulworth, or the gunnery school at Lulworth, and had various demonstrations and saw various things going on, individual training and so on, and sort of looked over tanks of various sorts and generally sort of learnt what it was all about, or tried to learn what it was all about from an individual point of view. Are you running out of tape?
No.
Yeah. Well, that was 35. As I say, it was down at Lulworth, and it was more individual training, if you understand what I mean. You know, the training of the individual rather than a unit. And we were shown tanks and shown tank guns and